Blog Talk Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا الله
It is quite easy nowadays to take a holy book like the Quran, read a verse from it, and take it out of context. This is particularly so if we are dealing with a important, significant concept such as jihad. So if I was to read the verse in the Quran, وَجَاهِدْهُمْ بِهِ جِهَادًا كَبِيرًا, and strive or perform jihad against them, a mighty jihad, one can easily take this out of context, and the implications could be quite severe. The concept of jihad is one of the most misunderstood, misused, and abused concepts today. In fact, the very term jihad and the term jihadi that we often read in the papers or hear on television, and also sometimes by politicians, to refer to people committing terrorist crimes in the name of Islam is offensive. It is offensive not only because it goes against the spirit and the letter of the law of Islam, but also because it goes against the basic definitions of jihad. The etymology or the origin of the word jihad, as far as Muslim scholars are concerned, is juhud, which simply means to strive, to make an effort, or to exert oneself in the pursuit of a lawful end. Technically speaking, one could say, I am now in jihad, where I am exerting myself in trying to explain to you a complex concept such as jihad. The word jihad is commonly translated in Western discourse as a holy war. And not only is this concept or definition incorrect, but it contravenes Islam's position on the topic. Why? Because, simply put, war is not holy. Full stop. Many leading Muslim scholars have defined jihad in its widest sense. And so, for example, Al-Raghib al-Asfahani, a 12th century scholar of Quranic tafsir or exegesis, and an expert in the Arabic language, said, jihad is of three types. One is the striving against the apparent enemy, the striving against the devil or Satan, and, of course, importantly, striving against our own egos or nafs, our own desires and our whims. And all these three types of jihad are included in the verse of the Quran where it says, وَجَاهِدُوا فِي اللَّهِ حَقَّ جِهَادِهِ, and perform jihad for the sake of God, a true jihad. Now, jihad needs to be understood in context. And that is why scholars look at the context to tell us whether the jihad relates to the jihad of fighting, or it is the struggle against one's own desire, or it is even the struggle in a day-to-day life to earn a lawful living for one's own family. This is substantiated by evidence from the sound narrations of the Prophet himself. So, for example, when a man asked the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as what is the most virtuous struggle or jihad? What is the most virtuous jihad? The Prophet, peace be upon him, said, a word of truth in front of a tyrannical ruler is a great jihad. Abdullah bin Umar relates that a man came once to the Prophet, peace be upon him, who was very excited and he wants to take part in a military expedition. And the Prophet returned to this young man and asked him a very important question, are your parents alive? The man replied, yes, my parents are alive. The Prophet then said to him, by serving them, you perform jihad. The type of legitimate jihad that involves combat and fighting is best known as qital. And given the very serious nature of this type of jihad and the destruction of life that may follow, it is governed by strict rules and regulations derived from Islam's sacred law or the Sharia. For example, the scholars look at verses like this one to talk about the limitation of jihad in the form of fighting. Therefore, the verse says, if they withdraw from you and do not fight you, and instead send you guarantees of peace, then God has opened no way for you to wage war against them. Elsewhere it says, fight in the cause of God those who fight you, but do not transgress the limits, for God does not love the transgressors. And this is a very important concept. In other words, even in a legitimate form of jihad, in the form of fighting, in the form of combat, something that is sanctioned by Islamic law, then the transgression of limits is not permitted, such as the killing of innocent people, bystanders, or anyone who is not in direct combat, regardless of their religion, gender, or age. Interestingly, Islam even prohibits the killing of such people under all circumstances and considers such actions as not a form of jihad, but rather crimes against humanity and are illegitimate as far as the sacred law of Islam is concerned. Jihad in the form of fighting can be valid under certain circumstances, such as defending one's own homeland against invasion or occupation, or even helping others who are subjugated to oppression and injustice, even though they are non-Muslims. And because of the very nature of the seriousness of fighting, it is heavily regulated, and the scholars of Islam distinguish legitimate forms of jihad in the form of fighting from acts of terrorism. In fact, all acts of terrorism fall under the term of hiraba. In Islamic legal terminology, hiraba simply means killing by stealth and targeting a defenseless victim in a way intended to cause terror in society. And so in determining whether an act is a legitimate act of jihad or it is an act of terrorism or a crime, Muslim jurists and scholars look at three particulars. And these are very important particulars that often even Muslims are unaware of. The first of these legal particulars is the target or the maqtul. And the second, the authority for killing out the fighting or the killing amir al-qital. And the third is the way in which the killing is carried out or the fighting is carried out, maqtul bihi. Essentially, if the target is an innocent person, a non-combatant or a bystander, then the act is considered prohibited in our sacred law. And this opinion is not a new opinion. It is an opinion that is based on a well-known principle in Islamic law, a dhabit, that simply says it is not permissible to kill the opponent's women and children if they are not in direct combat. And this is based on the prophetic prohibition on soldiers from killing women and children from the well-known hadith of Ibn Umar radiallahu anhu, may God be pleased with him, as narrated by Imam Malik, Imam al-Shafi'i, Ahmad, Bukhari, Muslim, Ibn Majah, Abu Dawood, At-Tirmidhi, Al-Bayhaqi, and so many others. In other words, there is no doubt about this principle in our sacred law. that the killing of innocent people, regardless of who they are, and regardless of what justification one may come up with, such acts are prohibited in our sacred law. Imam As-Subki, for instance, a 13th century famous scholar, he was a hadith master, he was a jurist, he was a Quranic exegete or commentator of the Quran, he was the chief judge of Damascus. And I say all of these qualifications simply to make a point that this was a man who was of immense scholarship. He made it unequivocally clear that what scholars have understood from this prohibition, in which the standard rule of engagement taken from it is this: a Muslim soldier may not kill any woman or any children unless they are in direct combat, and they can only be killed in self-defense. This is a standard principle in our Islam, in our jurisprudence, upon which there is consensus of opinion among the scholars. The nature of this prohibition is so specific and well-defined that there can be no legal justification, nor can there be a legitimate Sharia excuse for circumventing this convention of war by targeting non-combatants or civilians whatsoever. In other words, you cannot, under the guise or the label of anything to do with Islam, justify the killing of innocent people, or justify the killing of people who are not in direct combat with you, regardless of the excuse and the justification. Secondly, the question of declaring war or not is entrusted to the executive authority and to its decision. Islam came to regulate lives, and we believe that God has given us a divine law to regulate and facilitate our lives, to bring order to our life, not to bring chaos and anarchy. And therefore, in a very important matter, such as the declaration of war or the signing of peace treaties, it did not leave this matter to the whims of individuals or groups, but rather it is to be with the executive authority and its decisions. And compliance with that decision is the subject's duty with respect to what the authority has deemed appropriate in this matter. Furthermore, Muslim scholars throughout the ages have always told us that the executive or its subordinate authority has the option of whether or not to declare the war. What is happening nowadays in some of the Muslim countries, unfortunately, where you find groups of people emerging, declaring war against others, is problematic from the viewpoint of our sacred law. For the most basic legal reason, or the illa asliya, is that this matter, the matter of declaring war or not, is one that involves the public interest, and thus consideration of it belongs only to the authority. And all of this is based on a basic principle, a qaida, a principle in Islamic law, that the decision or the decisions of the authority on behalf of the subjects are dependent upon the public good. In other words, anything that we say or anything that we do, we must always consider the public good, the public interest, especially in a matter of declaration of war. And so the authority must act for the greatest advantage of all of its Muslims or Muslim subjects when it makes decisions regarding war and regarding peace. In Islam, there is an ethical principle that says the ends do not justify the means. We don't believe that the means justify, one can use any means to justify an end. To the contrary, the end itself must be lawful and justifiable in order for the means to be also lawful and justifiable. There is no question, in fact, among Muslim scholars, and there is no difference or khilaf on this by any judge or mufti or faqih or jurist, that using any means to attain an unlawful end, such as killing non-combatants in a place like Australia, for example, breaches the scholarly consensus or the ijma of the scholars. Recently, hundreds of Muslim scholars signed a joint response that was sent to the leader of ISIS, Baghdadi. In this open letter, they stated what I have already said, but then they added few more important points that are worth considering. For example, we have seen that ISIS had killed a number of emissaries or people who were not in direct combat, yet they were killed and they were slaughtered. It is known in our sacred law that the killing of emissaries is totally prohibited. And what is meant by emissaries here are people who are sent from one group of people to another to perform a noble task, such as reconciliation or the delivery of a message. But also importantly, Islamic law has always prohibited the fighting and the subjugation and the oppression and the harming of minority non-Muslim communities living amongst them. And one of those communities that have lived for the last 14 centuries among Muslims throughout the Muslim rulers of the various centuries were the Yazidis. Until recently, with the emergence of a group like ISIS, the Yazidis have lived in a secure and a peaceful environment among Muslims. The Yazidis have lived there, and now they have been exiled, they have been persecuted in the name of some twisted interpretation of Islam. There is a total prohibition on the harming of non-Muslims, especially those who live as a minority community, among Muslims who ought to look after them and protect them. And there is no justification whatsoever in harming them. As the Prophet himself has said, and he who harms a protected non-Muslim who is living among Muslims, then I shall be his adversary on the day of judgment. Anyone, therefore, who looks at the depth of definition and meaning of jihad in Islam will find that the Sharia or the sacred law has a broader definition of jihad that is wider than the meaning of military confrontation. Yes, we cannot deny the fact that Islam allows fighting and combat when necessary under certain circumstances that needs to be heavily regulated with the rules of engagement. The Sharia distinguishes between legitimate jihad and acts of terrorism that breach the fundamental rules of Sharia agreed upon by scholars and jurists. When making this distinction, it is always important, the scholars tell us, to examine the target. If the target is innocent person, anywhere and any time, then that act is illegitimate and is considered prohibited in our faith. But also they look at the authority declaring jihad, and Islam is adamant on the point that it came to regulate society, bring law and order, and not to create chaos and anarchy. And that is why for a case such as declaring jihad or fighting, it is the executive authority, the power of the day, that needs to declare that. And the means do not justify the end, or the end does not justify the mean in Islam. There are many fatwas or legal opinions that have been issued of recent time condemning acts in the name of Islam that end up killing innocent people, bystanders, under the guise of jihad. Unfortunately, however, often these statements by leading Muslim scholars do not make it in the media, for it is not sensational enough, perhaps. And that is why often we get asked, why don't Muslim scholars speak more against acts of terrorism? To this I reply that the Muslim community and Muslim scholars have condemned acts of terrorism again and again and again, and have been trying and have done on many platforms to distinguish between jihad and terrorism. Thank you for listening.